On today's episode of Attention Alva, we'll be speaking about a very important topic to all veterans, and that's harm reduction. Stay tuned. You won't want to miss this episode. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to Attention Alva, the podcast for the American Latino Veterans Association. We are really excited to have you join us today. I'm your host, Danny Vargas, chairman and CEO of Alva. In addition to these podcasts where you get to hear from inspiring guests, we'll also have a webinar series where you'll learn great information on really important topics. And keep an eye out for our future events by visiting our website regularly. We really want to thank our sponsors for these podcasts and webinars, JP Morgan Chase, PMI, Wells Fargo, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Accenture. If you like this video, please like, share, comment, and subscribe. I'm pleased to introduce our guest speaker today, and that's Jessica Shortall. I'll give her a brief introduction. Jessica Shortall is R Street's Safer from Harm Coalition Manager. She builds and leads a diverse bipartisan coalition supporting and amplifying R Street's work in harm reduction. Prior to R Street, Jessica was the Vice President of Corporate Engagement at Freedom for All Americans and Managing Director at Texas Competes. Previously, Jessica led two business coalitions, one in Texas and one nationally, making the economic case for LGBTQ inclusion in, at work and in our communities. Jessica's career has spanned the fields of public health, education, nutrition, and human rights, and she was the first director of social impact at Tom's Shoes. Jessica is the author of Work, Pump, Repeat, The New Mom Survival Guide to Breastfeeding and Going Back to Work. Jessica received her MBA on social entrepreneurship at the University of Oxford and her bachelor's degree in art history at Wake Forest University. She was also a school scholar at the University of Oxford. She lives in the greater Minneapolis area with a husband and two kids and their two rescue dogs. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here. And thanks for going through my wild and wandering career path there.
It's a very circuitous path, yeah. So, but we're glad you are where you are now. We're glad you're joining us today. Jessica, why don't you take a moment just to let our audience know how you got to this position and how you got into harm reduction as a field?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been doing this work in harm reduction with R Street for a year and a day. Yesterday was my 1 year anniversary. And so the coalition building part and the impact and public health parts are not new to me, but harm reduction as a specific area of focus was. So that's been a really great journey to learn the ins and outs of that issue. But I spent, as you said, the past decade building and leading coalitions of big businesses and chambers of commerce, industry associations, et cetera, making the case that, you know, for non-discrimination, equal treatment for everyone, including LGBTQ people, as an economic issue. So I really like a data-backed, evidence-backed case. And that case is very strong for the government not blocking people's access to harm reduction tools, which we'll get into what those are. So I like a case that is going to benefit society, communities, people, in the case of harm reduction, save a lot of lives, but that is firmly backed by data. And I really, you know, as probably is clear from working with businesses on LGBTQ issues in Texas and elsewhere, I really love a thing that maybe feels and looks partisan to some people, but when you dig into the evidence and the reasons for it, really is not, that there's a great reason no matter where you sit on the spectrum. So it's been really fun to apply all of that in this case.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you for doing what you do. I'm sure it has a great impact across the nation, across all different segments of society and communities and so forth. But as we get into your presentation, we'd love to hear more about your thoughts and the details of it. I would like to mention, though, that we were connected through one of our key sponsors, and that's PMI. So I want to give a shout out to PMI for the work that they're doing in terms of harm reduction and being able to put us together. So thanks to PMI.
I'm glad to know you. Super glad to be here.
Well, let's go. If you don't mind, let's go ahead and jump right into the presentation.
Yeah, by all means. If you can fire up the slides, because as you know, I'm not tech savvy enough. Hey, there we go. Okay, wonderful. So Safer from Harm is our coalition, sits within R Street. So R Street's a nonpartisan think tank, public policy organization that focuses on, I think, issues that aren't talked about enough, for which there's a strong bipartisan case, and where R Street sees cases for free markets and limited effective government. So that's kind of where we sit, you know, in terms of orientation. And so R Street's got all kinds of teams in tech and cybersecurity and elections and health, and insurance, you name it. I sit on our integrated harm reduction team. And I to build this coalition that's made up of organizations and people that care about that. So we're going to talk today about what is harm reduction real 101, how veteran communities are impacted by the issues that harm reduction can help address. And then a little bit on the kind of policy front, because that's what we look at R Street, is how our laws and policies do, don't, and can promote the inclusion of harm reduction in people's lives. So that's what we'll do. And, you know, jump and interrupt me anytime. So, okay, we're going to go real 101 here. What is harm reduction? So the basic concept is all of us behave in ways that put our health at risk. Sometimes that might be substance use. It might be, you know, that might be alcohol, tobacco, drugs, you know, both legal and illegal. It might be going out in the sun. It might be riding a bike. My kids play ice hockey. That's certainly, you know, not a risk-free activity. And everyone, sometimes, often, or always, takes steps to minimize those risks. So, you know, I might, with drinking alcohol, certainly find a different driver. I might drink water in between, make sure I've eaten. I might limit my consumption. You know, if my kids and I go in the sun, we're going to put on sunscreen. My kids wear hockey helmets when they play ice hockey and other padding and bike helmets and what have you. So all of that is harm reduction because it says none of us is going to live a risk-free life. Some of those activities, you know, our laws currently categorize as legal or illegal. But regardless, we all do things to reduce the risk to ourselves without saying we're just not going to do anything at all. Some of that is just being alive in the world. And some of it is that we see on the population level that just telling people to be abstinent from things that we think they shouldn't do doesn't work. It works for some people, but it doesn't work for everybody. And you know, if we care about everybody and the ways in which those behaviors affect them and affect communities, then, you know, we want to be able to give people access to things that even if they're not abstinent from whatever it is, that they are safer for themselves and for the people around them. But sometimes our laws, our regulations, our policies block access to information about what those tools are. You know, imagine living somewhere where, you know, I didn't know about hockey helmets for my kids, or it was illegal to access them and they're playing hockey anyway. So that's like, you know, kind of very neutral example. But that is true for harm reduction tools in substance use, which is mostly what we focus on. I'll get into what we focus on in a second. So we've got this vision of a society in which every person has access to information and tools to keep themselves safer from harm when they engage in behaviors that have health risks. And that seems, again, like to the point of things that everyone can agree on. I think people would mostly agree on this. It's when you get into the nitty gritty of what does that look like for drug use, tobacco use, sexual health, people start to get uncomfortable because these are topics that make us uncomfortable. I just mentioned the roots of harm reduction really started with people who used illicit drugs, helping each other reduce their health, social, and legal risks associated with that drug use. So maybe there are people there that do not want to be abstinent from using drugs, that cannot, you know, find a way, that have tried to be abstinent, maybe don't have access to the support systems. And so harm reduction takes a kind of neutral stance on that. We're not weighing in on whether people should be abstinent or not from an activity. We're saying we're pragmatists. We live in the real world. We know that some people aren't. Maybe they will be in the future, but today there are people that are non-abstinent in all kinds of behaviors. Do we care about them staying safer and healthier and in many cases alive? My answer is always yes. So, you know, the kind of traditional concept of harm reduction is things like sterile syringes, because when people share needles to inject drugs, that can spread HIV, it can spread hepatitis C, it can cause wounds and infections. So the idea that, look, people are going to inject drugs one way or another, access to a sterile syringe can reduce a whole host of both individual and community level public health issues. Things like test strips, now that we know that there's a lot of fentanyl in the illicit drug supply in the U.S., you can buy these little strips online, lots of places, that you know, crush up or dissolve your drugs and dip the strip into it to see if it contains fentanyl or other substances too. And that helps, you know, fentanyl is a, you know, in our illicit drug supply, and that's not what many people are trying to consume, but it's being passed off as other substances, and it can be very deadly. So we also have, things like overdose reversal drugs that people have heard of, Narcan, the brand name. There's lots of others. Naloxone is the, you know, the kind of non-brand name. That this is a harm reduction tool in that, you know, it, literally life-saving day to day. And then things like medications for substance use disorder. So things like methadone and buprenorphine for people with opioid use disorder can be highly effective tools to help people move back into a stable life, into work, into parenthood, what have you. So that's a kind of traditional understanding of harm reduction. We take a kind of more integrated approach where we look at all of that in drug use. We look at tobacco use, pardon me, and we look at sexual health. And because in all of these activities, we know that 100% population-wide abstinence is simply not a pragmatic expectation. So we don't spend our time thinking about, you know, 100% abstinence, because that's just not what is going to happen. Never has, never will. But there are lots of tools that can help people be a lot safer. And there are some really interesting intersections between these. They're not in silos. So people who, as I mentioned, inject drugs, spread of HIV is an issue there. Right. We definitely see some intertwining in drug use and tobacco use, for example. So there's lots of things that go on. You know, populations more impacted by, for example, HIV, maybe hepatitis, tend to have higher smoking rates as well. So we try to look at the intersections of these issues and of communities that are impacted. And so, again, I'll just sort of beat this drum one more time about abstinence. So take drugs or smoking, for example. Why not just stop? That's just not how this works. It's not how it works for human beings. There's very complex reason people consume substances. Same is true in sexual health. And telling people just to quit and giving them only options that require full quitting immediately and forever, a lot of times really translates to quit or die, because it means we're saying either you can quit and live and be healthy, or we're not going to give you any other options. So those are the two options. And we're not satisfied with that. We think that there's lots of in-between space for people to become, you know, be on a journey to better health and stability. So that's where we focus. So again, like, you know, on the kind of why harm reduction, it's just that, you know, risk is part of life. Some categorized as legal, some as illegal. Again, being abstinent can work for some, but not all. And sometimes even, you know, policies and messages that require abstinence can actually backfire. And there's a lot of evidence that they can do more harm than good. There's a lot of powerful ways for people to stay healthier, understand what you're putting in your body, understand the risks of various behaviors, sexual behaviors, you know, consumption of substances. So we look at the kind of those things and the tools. And one thing for those that are watching on video, you can see this on the screen. For those that are listening, I'll describe it. One question we get a decent amount of time is about the inclusion of tobacco in this harm reduction picture. And to us, this fits perfectly philosophically with what we're saying, is that people do things that are risky. There are people that seek out substances for a wide variety of reasons. And expecting people to just quit leaves a whole lot of people out from the potential benefits of better health. So in nicotine, and again, those watching on video, I think this is just worth diving in on. Nicotine is an addictive substance. But what you'll hear, and I am not a clinician, I'm not a researcher, but what you'll hear those folks who work in tobacco say is that nicotine's addictive, but it's the lighting of tobacco on fire that kills people. It is everything else, the many, many chemicals there, the tar and the combustion itself, the smoking itself, that is what makes cigarettes and you know, other tobacco products that are smoked so deadly. So when we think about that and we think about how the numbers show us how difficult it is for some folks to quit and for some populations to quit, and this is where we'll get into some of the veteran data in a bit. There are options that still meet people's desire or need. Physical need for nicotine, still meet people's, you know, social kind of ritual that come with smoking, but that are far, far lower risk. And there is reams of evidence behind this. You know, like actual academics and scientists are not in disagreement anymore that things like heat not burn products, e-cigarettes, vapes, whatever we would call it, nicotine pouches are far less dangerous to people's health, and that it is the smoking that is the deadly thing. So almost 500,000 Americans die prematurely every year still from smoking. And that is where we think about, should we not let adults, very clear, adults, access products that could save their lives? And my answer is always yes. So that's why we include tobacco in this picture. So just to get into a little bit of data about veterans, pardon me, I'm sorry. Spring and allergies are afoot. On the opioid front, and there's other, you know, other drug use as well, stimulants and so on, but I'll just focus on opioids for a minute. The stats are really sobering. If we profess as a country to care about veterans as much as we say we do, then we have got to care about the overdose crisis and about opioids and veterans. There's very complex reasons why opioid use is higher among the veteran community. I'll mention some of those. I'm not a deep expert in it. But veterans die from opioid-related overdose at about twice the rate of the general population. And that, to me, like I said, is a statistic that we really ought to care about. And we ought to be willing to use every tool at our disposal to start to impact that number. Diagnosis for opioid use disorder is seven times higher for veterans health users than non-veteran health users. Among those people that access those services, substance use disorders are associated with increased risk for suicide. And veterans with history of military sexual trauma have about 50% higher odds of having an opioid use disorder diagnosis. Not on here also is very deep connection between PTSD and drug use. And that is service-related or non-service-related PTSD. And there's quite a bit of kind of post-Iraq and Afghanistan data and examination of opioid crisis and that population of veterans. On the tobacco front, smoking is also higher. Of course, we have a long and unfortunate history of encouraging smoking among active duty folks. So, during World War II, the inclusion of cigarettes in, packages for deployed, for GIs overseas, et cetera. But there are other complex reasons too. But today, there's about 175,000 active duty service members who will die eventually in their life from smoking unless they are able to quit. PTSD also very deeply connected with higher rates of smoking among veterans. So somewhere between 53% and 66% and high rates of cessation failure, meaning that a veteran with PTSD who smokes is going to have a much, much harder time quitting smoking. And again, I won't get into why that is. I think, researchers are still teasing that out, but that's what the numbers show. Veterans Health Administration has found that abstinence from smoking is difficult to achieve, even when they've got a diagnosis of lung cancer for a veteran. So it is just an exceedingly hard thing to step away from. It's even higher among veterans who are homeless, and it's very expensive for the VA. So when we think about veterans, these two issues come first to mind in the harm reduction space to me. There's also, we don't work in the harm reduction space in alcohol per se, but it is a substance, and there are higher numbers among veterans. So 65% of veterans who enter treatment report alcohol as the substance they most frequently misuse, also co-occurs with PTSD. In the sexual health front, it's not that necessarily there's higher numbers among veterans, but this isn't talked about enough. HIV and sexually transmitted infections are on the rise across the population. So that's syphilis, hepatitis C and other STIs are rising. And so that's something that everyone should be concerned about. Some harm reduction folks, we don't work as much in cannabis. We have in the past, but of course, cannabis is part of this conversation too, with more and more states legalizing cannabis. There's also a potential positive impacts, medical cannabis being used to treat wounds of war, such as traumatic brain injury and PTSD. Our team, my colleague, Chelsea Boyd, does write and look at especially protecting those medical markets and making sure that our state and federal policies allow for medical markets and not just recreational markets, because those formulations of cannabis might be quite different depending on the person's use and need. So, again, we think mostly primarily on the drugs, tobacco, and sexual health, but it would be remiss to not mention these issues. So we have some issues with when the government, whether it's state or federal or sometimes municipal government, gets in the way of people's access to information first and then tools in these areas that I've discussed. So on the opioid front, where the illicit drug supply has now got a ton of fentanyl in it because it is so cheap. It is easier to make something and pass it off as, you know, a Percocet on the, you know, on the dark web or whatever, or on social media, or as heroin, but it's actually fentanyl because it is so powerful and so cheap. There are still some states where those test strips I mentioned to test for the presence of fentanyl or for another substance called xylazine are illegal. So programs can't hand them out. You couldn't go on to, if you live in Texas, you wouldn't be able to go onto Amazon and order these test strips and have them shipped to your home in Texas. Syringe services programs are not legal in some states. The Nebraska legislature just passed a bill in a very bipartisan manner, to authorize syringe services. So that's places that people can come and get sterile syringes and turn in used syringes, but they also offer so much more support. So people who use these programs are 5 times more likely to enter treatment for drug use and 3 times more likely to stay in that treatment and be successful. So they're really wonderful programs, but we're having this kind of more politicized backlash that Nebraska passed this bill, the governor vetoed it. The Idaho legislature has just repealed their law that's been in place for several years that authorized syringe services, so that state will no longer have it. So these are cases of, you know, where sort of government is stepping in and saying, no, you cannot have access to these tools. On the, you know, nicotine front, you have some places where e-cigarettes are taxed higher than cigarettes, which creates financial incentives to choose the deadly product. we've got municipalities and states, potentially the federal government, we're still watching that might ban flavors in these reduced harm options. So if you've got someone who, for example, you know, smokes a menthol cigarette and is trying to quit, the most obvious off-ramp for them, if they're not able to quit smoking, or maybe not willing to, because adults, you know, have their own choices about these things, would be a menthol flavored product that is far, far, far reduced risk than smoking cigarettes. When those are banned, it doesn't create that off-ramp for people. We also have a problem with rampant inaccurate messaging about that continuum of risk and about the very clear overwhelming evidence that these reduced risk products are in fact reduced harm to people. We've got overregulation of those medicines like methadone that can really have huge success in people's lives with opioid use disorder. And then there are barriers to access for medicines. It's a miracle. You know, you can take a medicine called PrEP every day. And if you do it consistently, that will prevent you from getting HIV. I mean, that's just a modern miracle, and we still have barriers to access. So we try to think about, you know, where is the government allowing people to access tools for themselves and where is it blocking? So that's a big part of what we look at. I know ALVA is also, you know, very interested in workforce. And so, you know, these issues that harm reduction helps, it's not a silver bullet, but helps to address, have significant workforce impacts. So there's like more than a million workers that are out of the workforce due to opioid use. In 2018, employers reported almost 3 million injuries, work injuries and illnesses, and more than 5,000 occupational fatalities related to opioid use. Industries like construction, mining, food services, healthcare, disproportionately impacted for lots of reasons. And so lack of access to these tools is keeping people out of the workforce, especially lack of access to medications for opioid use disorder. Smoking, too, can impact workforce, insurance costs, the health of the workforce. Also in many of those same industries, hospitality is a big one, for example, construction. So we try to think about those impacts as well, that harm reduction is good for individual people, also good for communities, and as part of a bigger picture of public health, good for employers and the economy. So the last thing I'll say is, you know, if folks are interested in learning more, we're at saferfromharm.org. You can subscribe for just a monthly newsletter. We're not spamming you. That's our kind of a rundown of everything happening in harm reduction in public policy and in evidence. I would also encourage folks to ask their health provider about medications for alcohol or opioid cravings or withdrawals. So those medications exist. Methadone cannot be prescribed by a doctor, but they might be able to, you have to go to a special clinic currently for that. But there are medications out there that can change your life if you're facing alcohol or opioid use disorder. For folks who are sexually active, taking daily PrEP for HIV prevention, especially if you're in a higher risk group, it's a daily medication. Like I said, I consider it a miracle. There's also something called PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis. So for people who have had a sexual encounter and worry that that encounter might have put them at risk for a transmission of a sexually transmitted infection, you can go and get an emergency dose of essentially antibiotics to help prevent that transmission, which I think that's amazing. I will mention syphilis because it is on the rise all over the country. Screening in pregnancy is super important because many people with syphilis don't know that they have syphilis. Congenital syphilis is when it's passed to the baby in pregnancy. And the stats around congenital syphilis are awful. I mean, significant mortality, stillbirths and neonatal mortality, and significant other health impacts and disabilities that can result in the baby from congenital syphilis. So get screened because there's medication that you can ask your doctor about and work with your doctor on. I'm not a doctor, but screening I think is great. And then, you know, asking if you are a person who smokes and are interested in reduced risk options on that front. I do this with a big asterisk because there's a ton of misinformation and misunderstanding, even among doctors, around the realities that things like vaping, like nicotine pouches, are far, far less harmful to your health than smoking. Some doctors actually think the opposite, which is untrue. So you can ask your medical provider, but there's also ways to learn just out in the world about what's out there. And again, not making any individual recommendations for folks, but things to learn more about. I also tell everyone, like, learning how to administer Narcan is the name brand, but naloxone, which reverses overdoses, I think is an incredible thing. It's like learning to, you know, CPR. So I keep a dose of Narcan in my car. You can buy it over the counter at pharmacies now. And there's a website called endoverdose.net that does a little online training so you feel comfortable doing it. It is very safe to administer. Most states have laws that protect you if you administer it from, you know, liability. But it is very safe and you could save a life. And then you can also, if you live in one of the most states where they're legal, you can go on Amazon or go to an organization called Dance Safe and buy fentanyl test strips. I have friends that have gifted them to their college bound students. I think that's a useful thing. If you or someone you know even consumes illicit drugs recreationally every once in a while, this is a great thing to do because fentanyl and xylazine too are so present in the drug supply. And that's where we hear about these kind of overdoses that feel like they came out of nowhere. But if you know what's in what you're about to consume, then you can make smarter decisions about whether to consume it, whether to, you know, make sure you're with somebody so that they can, you know, call for help or administer Narcan if needed. So those things, again, these make us uncomfortable because they cross over into territory where there are activities that are considered illegal and activities that a lot of us have kind of moral judgments about. But at the end of the day, they are life-saving. And to me, that comes first. So I think that's it for me in terms of content on what we do and why we care about it. And would be happy to chat about it more if you're interested.
So thank you so much, Jessica. It's really important information. I'm going to leave that last slide up there so we've got the contact information for or the websites for some of the information you shared. I did have a couple of quick questions for you, though.
Please.
I'm not sure if you have any statistics on hand or if you have just anecdotally or just broad knowledge on the subject. You talked about some of the areas where veterans have a disproportionate representation in some of these areas. Is there also an ethnic or a racial component where maybe the Latino community, the African-American community, et cetera, have a disproportionate representation in some of these areas?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do not have stats to hand. And so I won't opine one way or the other because I will just be absolutely terrified to make a mistake here. We do see some disproportionate impacts on communities of color, also on rural communities, where there are overlaps anyway, of some of these issues. There's also, I really wish I had it to hand, but I won't dare. But there's some interesting, you know, kind of different smoking patterns based on cultural and racial groups too, in terms of preference. This is not Latino specific, but one of the big things that you'll hear a lot today is that there's the Biden administration is discussing, and the FDA is discussing banning menthol cigarettes. Menthol flavoring in cigarettes because that is a flavoring that was used over much time by industry to market to Black communities. And so the numbers are much higher there. And I believe, again, I'm a little afraid to say this, but I believe that that number is higher for Latino adults as well. In fact, I'm Googling it. So CDC says 2018, 2019, 53% of Hispanic and Latino adults age 18 to 34, so it's a younger cohort, who currently smoked used menthols, compared to 39% of white adults in that same age group. So the number is higher. And I'm not going to opine on whether the federal government should ban menthol as a flavor. I personally am not going to opine on that. What I'm going to say is, if they were to do that, to me, it makes sense to then offer, if that's the person's preference for years or decades, that flavor, authorize some products that use that flavor and that are not deadly in the way that cigarettes are, that are much, much, much lower risk profile. That makes sense to me. And we do have seen quite a kind of slow process of the FDA authorizing reduced risk nicotine products like e-cigarettes and others. So yeah, there's certainly some disparities there and disproportionate impacts there, where, you know, if that flavor were to be banned in cigarettes, some people would quit smoking. And that's great. And the vast majority will not. And so the question is, can we create valuable and productive off-ramps for those people too, because they matter too.
And similarly, I know that many of our viewers and listeners are also parents. Are there particular things that we should keep in mind that are prevalent among young people, adolescents, teens, et cetera, that we should keep a close eye on?
Yeah, I mean, on the policy front, the T21 thing has been in tobacco and nicotine hugely successful. Mm-hmm. So raising the age to 21 has been a part of this kind of really incredible plummet in youth nicotine use. Mm-hmm. So we hear a lot of worries about youth nicotine use, and that is fair. I'm a parent, and so I think about it, and I talk to my kids and worry about it too. But the numbers are trending in absolutely the right direction. And we're seeing some really great trends there, that kids are turning away from both combustible smoking and the kind of spike that we saw a few years ago in vaping in youth. So those are really positive things that I think don't get celebrated enough. Mm-hmm. On the sexual health front, that is, you know, very much individual parental decisions around what conversations to have with kids. So I'm just going to leave that. On the drug use front, I will just say that it's a conversation I have with my older child who's entering high school next year, where we talk a lot about abstinence and about prevention. But I also give him the information about what's out there, whether it's for him or for his friends, because should he make a choice that I disagree with, I want my kid alive. So that's a conversation that I have. And there's some good data coming out that the abstinence-based drug education programs of my youth were on the range spectrum from totally ineffective to sometimes backfiring, because what you're being told is you take drugs once, you're going to be a zombie for the rest of your life and your life is ruined. And you meet one kid for whom that's not true. And now you think, were these grownups just lying to me? So there is kind of a conversation afoot around talking to youth, older youth, a little more realistically about what substance use looks like, about heavy prevention messages, but that treat them with some respect of understanding that we're going to be honest about some of the tools for prevention as well. We do not. I do not. I talk with my kids about prevention all the time. This is not something that our organization engages in the youth conversation. So I'm just saying this as a parent, that is a choice that I have made. But we have, in putting back my professional hat on, in our work, we are looking at these tools for adults. And access to these tools for adults.
No, and I appreciate that. And just to be clear, and just to highlight, emphasize, bold, and double click, you know, we're not condoning, let alone encouraging, the use of tobacco or illicit substances or engaging in risky sexual behavior. But what we are saying
at any age,
yeah, for adults and so forth. But I think to the extent that there are people who have fallen into these types of behaviors, the important thing is to emphasize that there are ways to be able to reduce the risk and the harm.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the conversation is about.
Exactly. And that's the kind of rhetoric we hear pushing back on harm reduction approaches, is you're encouraging drug use. That is the wrong question. Are you encouraging or not? Me if I told someone go do drugs, that would have no impact on whether they go do drugs or not, right? What we are doing with harm reduction tools is acknowledging reality. We are acknowledging that everyone knows that we are in a overdose crisis. We know that we are facing a really powerful problem with fentanyl. And so to not be clear-eyed about the existence of those things, to me, is sticking your head in the sand and letting people continue to die, letting communities continue to be impacted. So to me, this is just a very pragmatic acknowledgement of what is already happening and going, not, we cannot expect abstinence from everyone today, or frankly, ever, because that is not, we see that all of human history, that's not the case. So what, how can we, in addition to all of those treatment and prevention efforts that are so important, how can we make sure that people have tools, even if they are making those choices today, which we're not encouraging, we're not condoning, we are acknowledging that they're already happening.
Perfect. Excellent. Well, thank you, Jessica. It's the last opportunity to be able to highlight the website, the primary website where people can go to get some additional information. Can you repeat the
website? Our coalition is saferfromharm.org, and you can find your way to Our Street, which is our, you know, kind of parent organization as well. But come to Safer From Harm. You can sign up for our newsletter with harm reduction updates. I love to hear from people, so you can get to me through that website too. I'll talk to anybody, including those that disagree with what we're saying. I love that kind of stuff. So I'd be happy to hear from folks.
Awesome. Jessica, thank you again so much for sharing this important information with us today. And on behalf of the American Latino Veterans Association, I want to thank all of you for joining us today. We hope you enjoy the content. We hope you found it useful and informative. And we hope you join us for future webinars and podcasts. Please keep an eye out for information on upcoming events by going to our website frequently. Thank you again to Jessica for being our guest speaker today. And thank you so much, Jessica.
Yeah, I apologize, but I will absolutely die of horror if I do not say, as part of this, to every single person listening, veteran, caregivers, family members, thank you for your service. I'm so grateful to all of you.
Thank you. Thank you. And with that, I'll thank again our sponsors for these podcasts and webinars, JP Morgan Chase, PMI, Wells Fargo, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Accenture. Thank you all again for joining us. And as always, be safe, aim high, and thrive. Until next time, so long.